Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugapul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Noonuckle and Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service. And across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, a little more rain overnight and another overcast day. A bit of sunshine coming through the clouds and a few clouds moving around up there. So we haven't finished with the rain yet. And some communities, some towns have taken a fair beating, haven't they? But anyway, that's Mother Nature trying to give Mother Earth a good drink. Well, at the moment, I've got Sam Wagon Watson sitting in the studio with me. Hey, Sam,
good,
how you going?
Yeah, good morning, Uncle Tig, and good morning to all the mob out there, and acknowledgement to our elders and people, and thanks for tuning in.
It's good to have you just come in at the spur of the moment. I'm having a bit of trouble trying to track down my old brother, Joe Ross, up in the Kimberleys. I spoke to him last night, and he was all keen. I think he went to bed and turned his phone off. And it is only 7 o'clock over there in the Kimberley.
Yes, yes.
So it's a bit early. He might have had a late night. Well, he's an old fella like me. He's not going to party.
Oh, you get better as you get older, don't you?
I'd know better at what. That's what I'm trying to find out. Anyway. Sam, tell us your mob, your country.
On Dad's side, with his father, Birrigubba, up north there. And on his mother's side, Nana's side, Mananjali. And from Mum's side, there's Irish and German ancestry. So, yeah, I'm brought up in a pretty rich mix of cultures.
Mm. Now, your dad and myself, we share the same grandfather.
Yes.
That's where your name came from, and your dad's name, Sam, and your grandfather's name, Sam. So your great-grandfather was old Sam Watson, a man that come from Nebo, the Birrigubba, the Wirri clan. So just put that up straight, declare my interest here in talking to you. I mean, yes. You're my young nephew.
Yeah.
You're a David Yonipon winner from back in 95. You won the New South Wales Book of the Year in 05.
Yeah.
That book was Smoke Encrypted Whispers. What about Queensland? Have they acknowledged you or you're making any impact up here with your writing?
I've definitely got a lot of work in Queensland out of my writing, but it was odd that a book that I had to go to New South Wales and contend against some of the nation's best writers. I beat Tim Winton that year.
And who's he?
Tim Winton's probably one of our best. He's a young adult and fiction writer. One of the
highly rated
smoking guns of the nation.
Really?
With writing.
There you go. See, it wasn't all for nothing. You went down there, you come out in front of some of these leading, well-known writers.
Yeah, but, Queensland has such a wealth of Indigenous writers. We've got some of the best writers in Australia here, but we're always sort of pigeonholed into the Indigenous category. Recognised with mainstream writers still. When you walk into a bookstore, your books are sort of in the Australiana section. They're not with other mainstream Queensland writers a lot of the time. There's still a bit of a pigeonholing there.
What are some of the other issues with young writers like yourself from First Nations mob, our people, our community, in being published? I mean, do you have to write in a particular way that is that suits, or do you write what you feel and then you go out and chase the publisher? And is that always achievable? What are the challenges here?
There are some challenges. The publishing world, we definitely are unrepresented in the publishing world. Australia has a few burgeoning publishing house like Margabala Books in Broome. Unfortunately, Margabala Books is not very it's not very easy for an East Coast writer to access a West Coast publishing house. And of course, Smugglerbala, they're starting to get, see, in Australia, when you're a publisher, you need a distributor to get your books out there. It's not just the fact that you publish and you're on the shelves, but you do need a distributor to get you out to the audiences. And once again, the publishing machine, I mean, they're there to make money. They're not there as such to... I mean, there are arms of publishing that help promote Indigenous culture, but for them, at the end of the day, it's about making the bucks.
All right. So there's publishing and then there's distribution, very similar to music. You can get get your CD together, but you've got to get somebody putting it out there.
You can go out today and self-publish your own book, but it's all coming out of your own pocket. And to make the money back is very hard.
And then in those cases, like I'm a bit out of touch with the publishing of music and stuff, there's a very, very small royalty or a very, very small return because you're depending on somebody else to outlay their money, their resources, and they generally recoup 85, 90, 95% of that cost.
Yeah.
If the book sells for 50, you might be lucky to pull 5 or so, or the record, the album, the music.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going back 20 years, 30 years, I'm out of touch with this sort of stuff.
Mm.
But as an example, is that what happens in the publishing scene as far as written material, authors, writers?
The beautiful thing that what happened with me when I won the New South Wales Premier's Award, I was put on the HSC, so every senior student in New South Wales had to read my book, which was pretty nice because then I was on the road for a year just visiting high schools. And it was really good because as a kid we were brought up with a lot of... in the Queensland school system, reading A Streetcar Named Desire, set in New Orleans, had nothing to do with my culture here. A lot of books set in England that had nothing to do with the backyard in Mount Gravatt where I grew up, nothing to do with Sunshine Coast where I grew up. So it was very hard to relate to that, where with Smoking Cryptid Whispers, I was visiting kids in high schools in New South Wales. They'll make creating little DVDs based on my poetry. They'll creating little dioramas. They'll creating artwork. They'll writing poetry in relation to my work. So, they got it, and it was good. It was good to be able to, for them, I suppose, to be able to put a face and a character to the writing. So with the HSC, my book being on the HSC, I made a few dollars from that. And so why, but the royalty checks haven't been huge. Poetry's not well funded in Australia, it's a bit of a struggle. But at the end of the day, you know, I've seen a bit of the world. I've gotten up to Norway, and I've got a Norwegian publisher, and various countries across Europe are translating my work, and on the International Space Station. Poetry for the Japanese Aeronautical Exploration Agency, and
you've written for the Japanese Aeronautical Exploration Association.
Agency, they I started writing.
What would you write for them, fellas? Well, how would they ring up and say, "Sam, I want you to write us a poem"?
Yeah, basically,
we're the Japanese Aeronautical Exploration Association.
I thought one of my
agency.
Mates was pulling my leg.
Exactly.
I got a call from my agent, and they said, a professor from the Aeronautical Agency found some of your haiku on the net and was wondering if you'd like to write some poetry for the astronauts on the platform. I said, yeah, all right. Gammon, you know.
Yeah.
I'll send
the
invoice. They took the poetry and they paid me, and it was great.
Oh, good story.
So I'm
good
the
story.
First black poet to be launched into space, which is bloody good.
Look, as a young fella, young First Nations man, some of the issues facing not only young people, our community. One of the things that's coming through now for me is identity and the authenticity of identity, I suppose. And how do you define identity? Because, look, some of the situation at hand at the moment, as time goes by, as we get older, as we develop more in our thinking, some of us do, a lot don't, even in our mob, as we develop our community and build the capacity of our mob so that we're not continually being seen as this deficit model. I mean, I want to talk about that too, how this deficit model, we're always looked at for the negative experiences and not looked at for the positive and looking at the strengths and building on that. We've all got to go, always got to go cap in hand, but that's another yarn soon. Yeah. Identity for now. I see people come and go, and yes, a lot of people are now flying the flag. I'm Aboriginal. I'm Indigenous. My granny come from up around the Kimberley somewhere. Not too sure of the tribe, but I'm Indigenous. These sorts of things create a problem for some concern, a lot of thought going on in my head for an old fella like me that couldn't ride on a school bus when I was in year 8, 9 and 10, 66, 67, 68, because my mum was black. They didn't see me was black, but my mum was black. But I was called nigger and coon and black at school. So this identity, how do you see the identity issue for us, our people today?
I suppose everyone's got their individual
struggle. Exactly, that's what I'm asking you for.
I can relate to what you're saying because I remember in the 80s when Joe was still in power, grade 4 I think it was, we had to do a project on Aborigines. And I didn't complete mine because the curriculum they gave me was very different to what happened at home.
Your experience.
I didn't eat witchetty grubs. I'd never eaten kangaroo. And at the time, you know, that year they pulled pies from the tuck shop because apparently they had roo meat in them. So apparently they weren't fit for consumption. So the identity that was on the school curriculum in the early 1980s about Murray and Islander people was very different to what I experienced at home. And there was nothing in the curriculum about Torres Strait Islander people, yet I was brought up to acknowledge that back in the 70s, you know, people like Uncle Steve Mam, a very small, you know, Islander community that was building here in Brisbane, you know, were joining our mob on the streets, helping fight the struggle. So back then in the curriculum, Islander people had no voice or identity whatsoever. It was quite strange. And then into the late 80s, suddenly Midnight Oil came on the scene, you know, the Beds of Burning Tour. Suddenly at my high school, I was kind of an oddity because people were like, oh, it must be cool, Midnight Oil's touring, singing about Murrays. Aboriginal people must be all right, you know. There was that funny kind of acceptance where our identity, suddenly Indigenous identity was in popular culture as it hadn't been before.
Well, how did you feel? You got your white friends in school.
It was great. It was great. Yep. You know, suddenly I had kids walking around with the Wurrumpi band, single Black Fella, White Fella. I'm like, oh, God, he's a son of a farmer. You know, 2 years ago, he would have, you know,
exactly,
would have thrown the Abbo jokes and, you know, stuff like that.
So it was good to see that
it was suddenly cool.
Whites emerging,
yeah,
recognising and respecting and paying respect to black struggle, black issues.
Yeah. But I can also remember being a kid, there were kids in my class that had very European last names and they were never encouraged by the teacher to talk about their background. Names like Lorenzo and very, very Greek and Mediterranean names. We were all sort of Australian. We were never encouraged to talk about that side of our identity. And there's always something magical about the royal family. That just never got into my head, you know. When there's a royal wedding, we'd have to do projects on them. I'm like, what the hell has this got to do with me and my background?
In relation to identity and people that want to identify, looks like we've got a caller on the line. Sam, let's see who we've got.
Hello, Sam. Welcome
and to Let's Talk. How are we going, Al?
And Tiger, how are you?
Very well, very well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'd like to acknowledge the Great Spirit. I'd just like to mention a few. I'm an author, as Sam knows and as you know, Tiger, but there's one organisation, I don't know whether you've heard of, in Queensland, which helps with all sorts of arts, and it's called Access Arts. Their website is accessarts.org.au. Over the years, but I'm not sure if they do now, they have had a dedicated Indigenous officer. Bianca Beetson was the officer once, John Harvey was the officer, but that might be a help for people who are trying to push any sorts of art. The other thing, there's a worldwide group called Strategic Book Group, and as Sam just said, you know, most of these places you have to pay, but Strategic Book Group, they will get your book out there worldwide in about, you know, 20 countries, all Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Amazon all around the world, but Google Books, and I think it's about $1,000 you have to pay for that one.
And, very good, very good. Good to know.
The other thing, which I think has been a good avenue for my books, is just sending an email to all the libraries and go through state by state. You know, I shot a email out to the libraries, and back came a dozen or so in Queensland, for example, said, yes, send us your book, we'd like that. So I thought that was a great avenue.
Most certainly.
Yeah, no, yep. Definitely. Cold canvassing's definitely a great thing. When I started writing, there was no such thing as the internet, whereas now you can log on and see what all the literary magazines that do accept poetry and short stories. And actually started out Uncle Tig, setting myself a goal of sending out 3 poems a week to, I started sending out short stories, and the magazines wrote back and said, don't send us any writing again.
Yeah.
But one magazine said, oh, look, this poem's really good, we'll take that. And, so I started sending out 3 poems a week, and within 6 weeks, got published 6 times.
All right.
So I started from there. But
definitely cold calling?
Cold canvassing. Definitely
Thanks for that, Al. It's good to have a couple of leads and highlight the fact that Access Arts and Strategic Book Group.
Access Arts, they're a great mob. Strategic Book Group, I haven't heard of, but, if they got worldwide connections, and it's an avenue.
All right. The back onto identity. How do you feel? How do you see it? When you've got, and we're seeing more and more of people that are very questionable. Are the Aboriginal, and then they can their history, their knowledge, their understanding is very, very sketchy.
Well, Uncle Todd,
what do we do? I mean, it's getting to be a real dilemma for me.
How
do we deal with it?
Well, I think we're now living in a climate, Uncle, where it's safe to be. To acknowledge being a black fellow.
And that's got to be a good thing. That's got to be positive, where people feel okay, because there was a couple of generations back where our old people didn't. They were Indian, some other country. They were another nationality.
Yeah.
And they had to be because they could be targeted. The kids were at risk of being taken away and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's got to be a good thing that people are feeling okay about it. But what about when they say, we can apply for AB study. Now, AB study is no different to Aus study. Or we can apply to IBA, Indigenous Business Australia, for the Indigenous housing loan, where there might be 0.5% difference in rate. Or there might be something else where we need to go and get an Aboriginality, confirmation of Aboriginality.
Yeah, that's crazy.
These issues.
I actually carry one with me now because I get asked for it, whereas never before.
It's ridiculous that we get asked for it.
I remember years ago applying for AB study when I got into uni, and they said, oh, can you prove you're Aboriginal? I'm like, what do you want me to do? Shake a leg at the counter? I'll drag a wallaby and rub 2 sticks together, know?
Yeah.
But no, they said, oh, you've got to get a form and go find an organisation. I'm like, well, how can I do that? But they're just, there wasn't that network out there. But now there is. And once again, I think some people, Uncle, they just feel safe enough to be able to acknowledge. But then again, when I was a kid, when you did acknowledge, it wasn't that dangerous. in my generation.
No, in your generation.
But your generation as a kid and definitely our grandparents' generation, there was a certain element of danger in the air when you did acknowledge.
So you got people that can tick the box. Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander, are you Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander? Yes, tick the box. But a lot, and this is where my problem lies, a lot don't go any further than that. They tick the box and they go off living in a white world, living their white way, not knowing, not expanding or growing their knowledge and understanding or identity, not even growing their identity. Mm. A lot do that. This is where my problem lies, box tickers, I call them.
I look at the wonderful thing about the lucky country, Uncle, is that, you know, behind closed doors we can have our comfort zones. And a lot of people, you know, think it's just too good, I suppose, the comfort zone.
Yeah, yeah.
To actually mix with community, I suppose.
I suppose, my issue is, like your father, we marched on the streets as young teenagers. We got bashed. We got locked up. We were involved in establishing organisations to try and improve, as a lot of our mob did at the time, you know, to try and improve the situation for our mob in communities. And then you get people come along and want to sort of, enjoy the benefits. And that's all well and good. But you've got to be able to get a bit stronger in your identity. Know the true history of your people, the country.
Yeah.
Bring your kids up.
Yeah.
And tell them, your great-grandmother was a Yorta Yorta woman.
Mm.
You know, your great-grandfather was a Waka Waka man. These sorts of things. That's what sort of bothers me, that it doesn't continue on. Tick the box and it's all well and good from there. And there's no questioning. And there's no way that we can set up any real checks and balances either.
No.
Because we've got the unfortunate situation of our mob being stolen, like Grandfather Sam Watson, being taken from his mother, never saw her again at 5-year-old. And other people in the similar situation, the stolen generation mob, that can't tell you where their mob is from or who their parents, grandparents were. So it's a real predicament. But look, I wonder if anybody does have any of those issues or want to talk about them, 3892-0188, you can give us a call. I'm talking to Sam Wagon Watson in the studio, and we're talking about a range of things. I want to come back and talk about this. What are your thoughts as a young First Nations man about the capacity building with our mob in our communities? But the fact that we're always coming from this, we're seen as a deficit model type thing. We got to present the negative issues. Child abuse or alcohol abuse or violence in the home or whatever it might be, in order to get a rehab centre or to get some treatment or to improve our lot. That's a struggle.
Yes.
But we could also go along and say, listen, we regard ourselves as the world's best environmentalists due to our track record, our 100,000 years of surviving and managing our land and looking after our country. We're regarded as the conservationists that you've never met before.
Mm.
We've got a track record. So rather than build on those strengths and employ our mob to do Coast Watch maybe?
Yes.
Where they know those isolated regions of northern Australian coastline, they know them like the back of their hands, and have them paid and put on a job instead of on CDP or something, rather than develop and recognise these strengths and build an economy or just a job around our strengths for some of our mob in those communities. So there's this deficit view on us and how we're coming in with this negative thing.
Yeah, I think we're definitely utilised for the stereotypical.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, like facets. Playing football or jumping in the ring with a pair of boxing gloves.
We've got to... We can shake a leg and dance, do a dot painting. Yeah, we can open a centre or a footy game. Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, let's have a song. And I've just heard that my brother Joe Ross is about to join us. So.
I don't want to go off air now.
We might. You want to stay?
I want to go.
You can stay with us and we'll talk to Joe.
Yeah.
No, look, I do appreciate you coming in and filling the gap.
Thanks, Uncle.
Better for people to hear from somebody else, and a younger fella too, with your experiences and achievements. than be listening to me. Maybe I'll talk to Joe Ross. Well, give us some thoughts first before we even go into a song. What are your thoughts on developing, on building on our strengths and achievements? What are your thoughts?
Oh, definitely. There's so many untapped resources in our community. It's the stereotypes. We're still fighting basic stereotypes, Uncle. But
there is merit, isn't there? I mean, we've got enough achievement. There's enough strengths in our community in order to build on and to develop.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I suppose just being in the right place at the right time and, jumping on those opportunities, opening wider avenues. Yeah.
Keep on chipping away.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you see? What do you want to see for this young fellow of yours? Your boy, what is he, 16, 17?
16.
Looks like he's 20-year-old.
Oh, yeah, no.
The little fella, 2-3-year-old?
Yeah, yeah, and they're blonde hair, blue-eyed.
Yeah.
And they're mad little black fellas.
Now, what do you want to see for them? What changes need to take place in order for them to be respected, for them to be able to have a quality of life? What do you want to see
I definitely want to see an education system that... that takes everyone on their cultural merits, not pigeonholing the kids. Oh, look, yeah, I suppose this is something for another day about a wider talk.
You'd like to see some change?
Oh, definitely. I'd like to be able to say to my kids, you know, it's safe to actually talk to bullymen. It's safe to talk to government. It's safe to open up to these people. I do get worried that if Samuel goes out on the streets and he gets picked up in question, that his name and his identity may backlash on him. He gets it at school too from other Murray kids. He's had it at his high school. You know?
Yeah.
He wasn't
invited. Get questioned by your own mob because your fairness of skin.
He wasn't invited to cultural studies because one teacher felt that he came from a good family and didn't need it. The other Murray kids thought, oh, well, he's too good.
Yeah. Yep.
He's too good for us.
Yes.
And so now he's sort of come up and he doesn't get involved with the cultural stuff at school. And it upsets his Nana and Pop because they want to see him there. But, you know, he's sort of grown up with all the punk, rocker, music kids. So he feels more comfortable in that environment because, you know, the Murray kids have sort of sidelined him.
Yes, all because of the decision or the perspective of a teacher making a call.
Yeah.
Bit sad.
Yeah, definitely.
Right, Sam. Hey, thanks for joining us.
No worries, Uncle.
Good to have you sitting in here for a while.
I'll get back to work.
All right, then. Cheers. Good on you. Yeah, you better tell your boss my apologies for dragging you away without talking to her.
No worries. And, goodbye to all the way there. Have a good day.
He is a northern Western Australian man, as Ted Wilkes is down from the south. A Boonaba man, Joe Ross. Joining me. Joe, how are you, brother?
How are you, Tiger?
Yeah, I'm going well. How are you? You good?
Oh, not too bad.
You're on the road.
Did you say you had Ted Wilkes on the show?
Pardon?
Was he singing or was you
Ted Wilkes on the show? Yeah, he was singing that song, No More Younger, one of his old recordings from way back. He's got a few new ones down. He spoke to me last week. I had him on the program here a couple of weeks ago in his capacity of chair of that First Nations or the Aboriginal, the NIDAC, I think, or the Indigenous Advisory Council for Drug and Alcohol Advisory Council. Yes, and had him on the show talking about the report that was done and being highlighted, this reinvestment, justice reinvestment being highlighted, that don't build more jails, have jail as an extremely last option and build more centres that might assist people from stop people going to jail rather than building jails and waiting for them to come in through the door.
Yeah, he's a good man, Ted. He's done a lot of hard work for Aboriginal people.
Yes, he is a good man. I've known him for near 40 years, old Ted, and he looks a lot different now, as we both do, me with no hair. That big white beard and stuff, you know. He certainly looks the elder, the man of wisdom and stuff. It's great. Now, you are a Boonaba man, Jundamurra country, one of the great warriors, fairly well-known warriors, and a film made about Jundamurra. That's where you're from, that country.
Yeah, if I could say, cousin, always good to be on your show every so often when you give me a call.
Yes.
And one of the people to the north-northwest of the township of Pittsburgh, Cousin. And we, after about 14 years of sitting in the line waiting, we had a consent determination over a part of our country. The title determination, and the federal court came and set up it out in, on our country. And gave us the first of our determinations. Made all our people happy and old people happy.
This is the first determination under the Native Title Act for your people.
Yeah.
It's been 14 years of work gone into it.
Yeah. It wasn't a sort of a, we didn't have an argument with the state. It was just a time it took to have other Native Title cases heard and all that.
All right. You're on the road. You're travelling from Fitzroy Crossing, what, a 400K drive on the road going to Broome.
Yeah, just coming into Broome. And there's a been coming through a lot of rain lately because we got this cyclone that went past us, Rusty. And came down in the first big cyclone of the season here. And not like you're Queensland, obviously, had plenty of cyclones and rain over there already. And so anyway, sitting just off the coast of out of Port Hedland there, south of Broome, but dragged all the rain behind it.
All right. That's
Well, I left about 4 o'clock.
You've been driving since 4 o'clock, your time. And it's now almost, it was 7:45, your time. You're 2 hours behind, 7:40.
Yeah.
All right.
Bridgman Road.
All sealed, yeah?
Lucky.
Yeah, very lucky. Very lucky. The, we'll see how we go with the phone. It's a little bit crackly. It might improve as you go along. It'll be that car speaker phone. That's what it is. You're not talking while you're driving.
Might be just the road noise.
Might be that too. Yep.
I was hoping to be in Broome by the time you rang, but
the weather's not the best. Flat. Yeah.
How's that?
Yep. That might be a bit better. Let's see how we go. Now, the Native Title determination, what does it give you? What's the win for you? You'll recognise as traditional owners of the area. What are the positives about this determination? Why is it important to your mob?
Well, the recognition of our rights and connection to country, and all our people are come off a few properties and in and around Fitzroy Crossing stations and that, and we're always in conflict sometimes with the non-Aboriginal pastoralists. A lot of the pastoral leases are non-Aboriginal owned, and also we've got three pastoral leases that ATSIC and government bought us. We managed to get exclusive rights over that. And so for the oldies that have gone and some of the oldies that are still here with us, it was the end of a dignified sort of process of just saying this is our country and we're happy to, welcome anybody else in our country. But we don't want to be, discriminated against and demarcated against. But it's been a bit of a sad process for those that started the Native Title who passed on. But for young people and old people, it was a very happy day. It was on the 12th of the 12th last year, so in December. And also it's good for our young people to who are struggling with the changing times and identity and that, and so we can show them where they're from and what country they belong to within our Bunuba lands. And then the other part is with exclusive rights, it gives us a ability to negotiate around mining or ability to do potential carbon projects like fire burning and fire abatement projects and that with Nailsborough up in Darwin. So there's some sort of future potential economic opportunities.
That's an important aspect of it, economic development for our mob, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, we and
And with the fire burning, this climate change business, is there some opportunities there for you, you say?
Yeah, well, Nailsma up in Darwin, Joe Morrison and all his crew with CSIRO managed to get approved technology, approved methodologies. And so on the northern side, we've got above 1,000 mil rainfall. That's the ability to use that methodology there. But then the next lot of methodologies in the savannah systems, and that's mainly where all our country is, we're working with Nailsma to be able to get it proved up. And then once it methodologies get approved by the agency that the government, federal government has, we're able to then go out on country and do fire management projects, you know, and then being paid for it by gas companies or mining companies to offset their carbon.
Is that the important part of it? When you're talking about approved methodologies, approved by the federal government, will allow you to go out. You can go out anyway, can you not, and do what you need to do on your own country? But if it's an approved methodology, and this is a question to you, if it's an approved methodology, does that mean you can, like, be contracted to do this sort of work or something? What's the importance of methodology and approved methodology?
Big companies like gas companies and coal companies and factories and that, they have carbon emissions that go up in the air, and they've got to be able to offset that and show that they're saving carbon emissions elsewhere. And so a very good example of that is ConocoPhillips, the big oil and gas company in Darwin. It has a contractual arrangement with the West Arnhem Land people, and they get paid $1 million a year to do fire burning, like fire management project in their country. So the technical bit is about the methodologies and actually entering into those contracts. But the good thing is they get paid for it, and then that money then goes to be able to get people back out on country. And through that, they start to also get taught by the elders, not only about fire management, but also about where they're from and where they're connected to and where they belong to, and get them out of the towns and cities and get them employed and have a sense of purpose in the community. So at the end, that's the real practical outcome, which is a great benefit to Aboriginal people when they can get these projects going.
And it's allowing our mob to continue on with those cultural practices that have been around since time immemorial, really, hasn't it?
That's right. And so fire management and that connectivity to their country and connection to country even strengthens it even more. And just continues to demonstrate the rights we've had for thousands of years and the ownership of our country and the knowledge of our country.
So that's a fine example then of the opposite to this deficit model, where we're looked at from a deficit with a deficit, this ball around our neck, so ball and chain around our neck, where we come as a deficit to the table to negotiate. Whereas another paper that you were involved in writing for IATSIS, the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Islander Studies, you were involved in writing a paper with Scotty Gorringe a couple of years ago. That was an aspect of that. There was an element of this in that paper. I think what was the name of that paper? I didn't even make a note of it. But you talked about the need to identity and the need to recognise the strengths of our people and our practices and stuff, and be able to build on that, build the capacity, economic development. And this is a fine example of that now, what you're talking about.
That's right. And the people have this perception of Aboriginal society in Australia. And of course we've had our trials and tribulations around what's happened to our people over the last 100 years, and we're bearing the impact of that. But there's a lot of strengths in our communities, and this carbon project that Walfa does the West Arnhem Land people do is a very good example. They're coming from a strengths-based approach, of which they have offered their services and their traditional knowledge to be able to contribute to the liabilities ConocoPhillips, the oil company, might have, but they also are contributing to a greater challenge the world has in around limiting our carbon emissions and stopping this earth getting, you know, hotter and hotter. So what we spoke about there is everything seems to come from the negative side, and money coming out of governments being for all the negative things in life. And we really should be investing in the positive and the strengths of our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities.
What other avenues?
What we can contribute, you know?
Yeah. What other avenues or examples that you may know of that do this, look at the positive sides? I mean, I've used an example quite regularly of across northern Australia, the coastline, the illegal fishermen, the problem there, and
the stuff. Ranger projects, you know, all the ranger projects.
Yes, what are they?
There's a very good ranger program that's up at Mapoon, and up there they provide services to the state, who look after a variety manage a lot of ecosystems. They manage the nets that get dumped in the ocean. They
Those
also
ghost nets,
manage
a ghost net
the biodiversity.
Project.
Yeah, the ghost net projects in the Gulf.
Mm.
But in Mapoon, they're looking at and managing, say, the turtle population. That's very important to the ecosystem and the biodiversity of that area. And all these people there are really a shining example of what can be done from a strength space.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there's ranger programs throughout the whole of Northern Australia and down the coast and on the islands, Torres Strait Islands and that, and they provide services. And there's also, like, the Torres Strait Islanders being able to, they want to live in the Torres Strait Islands because they're traditional owners and they belong to those islands, but there's also a biosecurity risk to Australia. And a very good example of that is, say, like foot and mouth disease. God forbid if any foot and mouth disease hits our agriculture in Australia. But the Torres Strait Islander people do provide biosecurity services through, you know, working with AQUIS and being vigilant and being alert enough to ensure that unwanted diseases don't come into Australia.
Right. So there are some projects,
get paid for it.
Yes, and get paid for it. Yes, there are some projects where our mob are benefiting financially, where they can have an income and some responsibility and continue to maintain their cultural practices as well.
Yeah,
good position
to
be.
The other thing that we spoke about with Scotty Gorringe, and we had attended a session there in Ipswich, I think it was, if I remember right, and about identity tiger.
Yeah, that Ipswich group, I see mention of Keeping Families Stronger group is what you're referring to.
This thing they call lateral violence. And
yes.
How sometimes our Aboriginal families and communities and leadership and that get into this sort of tall poppy sort of self-destruct mode and start taking it out on themselves instead of being united and recognising our, you know, differences even in our own Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community.
Yes, and there are. We are as diverse as any other community or any other group of people, race of people. So,
that's right, and Aboriginal people in Tasmania shouldn't be no less Aboriginal people than in my community in Pitrock Crossing.
That's right, yeah.
And just because we live out in remote areas and we haven't had as much impact as from colonisation as Eastern Australia or down south, it doesn't mean we're any more Aboriginal than, you know, people from Tasmania, New South Wales, Queensland or anywhere.
Yes, and it's...
What you believe, eh?
It is. So what is it about identity for you? What defines you as a Boonwurrung man? What is it about identity? Because this identity thing is getting to be a real discussion piece across the mainstream media, by some of our people that are in become politicians over in the Northern Territory recently, elections over there before Christmas, saying different things about identity.
Yeah, and trying to create this class of Aboriginal people that live out in remote areas and being any different than people that live in the city, Aboriginal people.
Being more Aboriginal, and we're too white over here on the East Coast, some of us people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like you take, I say, I'll give you my example. My father was, my mother was Bunuba lady and one great matriarch of our people. She passed on. And very well respected, and I grew up with my uncles and my community and law and culture in Fitzroy Crossing, and I know my country and where I'm from my mother's side. And then on my father's side, my father was one of those old orphans from Liverpool. Came out in 1938 when he was 11 years old. And he came up 18 years old in the Kimberley and at some point met my mum in 1949. And they lived together till 1996, till she passed away, and married. And so I grew up with a black and a white mother and a father, parents. And I don't see myself as any different being Aboriginal or being, you know, non-Aboriginal. I just see myself as being Bunuba and where I'm from and where my country, you know.
Mm.
And I have to respect everybody else's country. It's like they should. I should get the self-respect for our community, Bunuba community. But native title, I can tell you, is one of those points in life that really challenges communities because, you know, some people have been brought to someone else's country for no reason, like stolen children and being removed. And when native title comes in, it just targets and focuses in on the traditional owner of that country.
So a further, more divisive way.
It can be divisive. And what I've seen in Australia, where the traditional owners have been acknowledging and respectful of the whole Aboriginal community in their area and their ability to share the country and recognise people that have grown up with them, that's where you have happy and vibrant communities.
Mm. This native title thing, it's a white construct. It's from a colonial perspective. They have the power to determine the traditional owners who are, who aren't. So they have the power to create, I suppose, what the conditions are, whether the traditional owners do get a positive determination and stuff like this. But my point is here, is it similar to back 150 years ago, 100 years ago, even less, when these same people, the colonisers, were selecting one or two of our mob and saying, now you can be King Jackie and you can be Queen Mary and we'll put this breastplate around your neck. And you can go off. You can go off. Your name's engraved on it and stuff. And you're really superior now to everybody else. Is this the same sort of thinking, is it not?
Yeah, well, some places and the determinations can be like that, Tiger.
In some places, yes. That's my point.
Yeah.
It's this thinking and...
Very divisive.
Very divisive. Not.
And then you get like... Then you get like, you know, within their communities and even in my community, we have rampant discussions around, you know, who's more Aboriginal than another person, you know? And it's like, yeah, right.
And then you got some of the mob that sort of just find out they're Aboriginal, great-grandmother come from this country, that country, and they're Aboriginal, and they know little, they tick the box, yes, I'm Aboriginal because I just found out my great-granny. And that causes some issues within the community, acceptance, identity, and continuing to develop or not continuing to develop their own identity because they've ticked the box and that's it. There's some real divisive issues there.
That's right. And it's very sad when you see it and experience it. And a lot of it boils down to sometimes families and some people just all they want to do is get acknowledgement and be respected, and I, you know, see a lot of stolen children when they were, you know, torn away from their mothers
in the 20s and 30s, no, they, you can't blame them for having their children and grandchildren grow up in your country.
Yeah. And we've got to be mindful that we don't practice what has been or put on us. We don't put on other people what's been put on us, the denial of our identity.
That's right.
That's been questioned and denied in a lot of cases. Yes, exactly, from the coloniser. And sometimes we can adopt that same attitude because we say, well, how black are you? And I'm a good one for that. I'm often questioning my mind. Well, how black are you? What do you know about your mob? What do you know about the struggle? And it's a real dilemma. A real dilemma for not just the people that are claiming to be Aboriginal, but for people like me that sit around and try and sort of pass judgment in my own mind. Yeah.
And then they get like where Fitzroy Cushing, and we, the traditional owners, one of the people, we have to also respect the non-Aboriginal people that grew up with us, you know?
That's right too.
I've got a lot of Gemalis and friends and families and that I'm close to, that are non-Aboriginal people, and they got to be respected in our community too and acknowledged for their contribution to the society as a whole there, you know, because what makes our little community healthy is everybody makes it
That's
healthy.
Right. So it comes down to respect and respect for humanity, respect for people. Mate, we got about 20 seconds for news. I appreciate your time with us. You've finished up on a great point by saying that it comes down to respect and respecting people, not a colour thing, it's a respect thing.
Yeah, but it's going to be it's growing momentum, this discussion, Tiger, and it's good that you constantly facilitate it. So
appreciate hearing from you, my brother.
And your listeners, mate.
Thank you very much. You have a great day. We'll talk to you later,
Cheers.